Good evening, everyone, here on Wall Street and out there wherever you all are in the Mahasangha, the great Sangha out in the world. As Carmen just said, this is the fourth of 6 weeks that we're spending on this theme that I called What Does Love Have to Do with Zen? And I chose that title because you don't really find the word love in Zen texts very much. You do in the earlier Buddhist texts in the context of what are called the Brahma Viharas, the four noble abodes of the four immeasurables, loving kindness or love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. But you don't hear the word love so much in Zen. But you do hear the word shin in Japanese or Chinese, shin, and it means heart and mind. So if you count those, Zen is just full of heart and mind. And so we're looking at how our practice supports the capacity to give and receive love. And we've talked about what love even is, because of course it means so many different things. And I've been taking kind of a developmental approach, talking about how starting from early infanthood, we develop the capacity to be in relationship, in loving relationship, giving and receiving with our mothers or whoever our primary caregivers are. And we've talked about some of the things that impede, get in the way, or distort our capacity for love. But we learn as it's modeled and given to us, always in relationship, right? And we sort of started with loving ourselves and then developing our capacity to love in terms of our family relationships, which are, of course, pretty much lifelong, whether we like it or not. And how that way we learn about love in our family and then later our social environments so often is conditioned by the approval or disapproval of others, right? So it's conditional love. And how we internalize that conditioning by forming what we could call the inner critic. We talked about that last week. And how the inner critic, in a sense, the inner job of the inner critic is to kind of preempt that judgment coming from the outside, because it's so painful, right? It's so painful to be rejected or punished or ridiculed or, you know, by those who we thought were supposed to be loving and caring for us. So that's so painful, so we try and control it, right, by getting ourselves to behave right. So we will be approved of and loved. And that's the inner, so the inner critic takes on that job to get us to behave right. But then those patterns become entrenched. And they don't always serve us, right? Later on in life, if we fall into those same ruts of behavior. And then we also form an outer judge. Sometimes we direct that criticism outwardly in a deluded effort to control or cut off others so they won't hurt us. Right? So both the inner critic and the outer judge ultimately end up not really serving us, not really they're cutting us off from loving relationships. So we can not only observe but actually feel how those patterns impede our love for others and for ourselves and the world, how we just express our lives in the world. So I think the most important thing our practice can offer us in this regard is the capacity to be present and attend to the pain of what John Wellwood, on this book I've been recommending, what he calls the wounds of the heart. This book is called, as I've shown you, Perfect Love, Imperfect Relationships, Healing the Wounded Heart, the Wound of the Heart. And our practice allows us to see into the roots of that suffering, of our wounded hearts. Are people on Zoom hearing me okay? I know it. I'll try not to turn away.
No, it's not. It's on.
Oh, it's off.
Yeah, it's off.
Sorry. Are we okay?
They
are nodding. They seem okay.
They're here, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
They seem okay. Okay, continuing. It's important that we see into the roots of our suffering, of our wounded hearts, because the results of that wounding extend far beyond our individual lives. The causes and then the results, which is karma, right, extend both into the past and into the future, generations of family history, and ultimately the common ground of the human condition. And we talked about, I think the second week, one way we practice with our human imperfection, because we don't love perfectly. None of us do. None of us do, right? And we aren't loved perfectly, always. And so we must learn about forgiveness, the practice of forgiveness. And in our practice, forgiveness isn't something externally bestowed. It's not even something that's earned. We could say it's a deep seeing into the roots of our suffering with the eyes of wisdom and compassion. When I was talking about forgiveness before, I wanted to, or last week when we were talking a little bit about family, I wanted to give you this little quote from our teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, from his book, Taking Our Places, The Buddhist Path to Truly Growing Up. And it's about how our practice supports becoming fully mature human beings in this world. And he talks about forgiving our parents. And he says, I'm sure that we all reach adulthood with a need to forgive our parents simply for being who they are or were. Many of us never do forgive them. Although our adolescent anger may subside, we go on for a long time harboring a heavy weight of guilt and occlusion in relation to our parents, a weight that we feel in our own living as a blockage of energy or love. So whether or not we are interested in making peace with our parents for their sake, we need to do it for our own. And then he goes on to talk about a friend of his who's a geriatric psychotherapist, who runs support groups for the elderly, most of whom in this group were over 80 years old. And what was their number one topic? Their grievances against their parents. So we think, is that what I want? Yeah. We humans, as social beings, have a deep need for connection. And our first connection is with our parents most of the time, not always, and they will inevitably fail us to a greater or lesser degree. And maybe that is exacerbated by the modern nuclear family, where there are often few connections to extended family or community to kind of buffer the parent-child relationship. and smaller families too, right? If you want to read more, check out the whole chapter. It's a chapter, his chapter on connection. There's some wise and humorous words that he shares with us. But as we move through adolescence into early adulthood, for many, one of our strongest needs is to form a strong bond with a partner with whom we share our sexuality, our interests, the everydayness of a household, and possibly raising children together. We have a strong urge to seek love and all that means to us in a very close, a couple relationship. And those relationships can bring us both the heights of joy and delight and the depths of pain and misery, right? The whole gamut. Human beings are nothing if not adaptable and variable, so there are a great many cultural and historical variations on how we do this. You know, how we form families or raise children or bond in pairs. And there's been endless debate on how monogamous we are, how much gender difference there is in our pair bonding behaviors and attitudes. And we're not going to spend time on that tonight because people have written whole books on these ongoing questions. But what I'd like to look at is the way our intimate relationships are sort of a crucible for attending to and healing the wounds of our hearts. So they really are a very fertile ground for our practice, for our practice of awareness and paying attention. By the time we begin to form intimate relationships, we've had some glimpse, at least, of what's called unconditional love. And often, our glimpses of unconditional love come at endings or beginnings, you know, births, deaths, beginning of a new relationship, and when there's a kind of unimpeded love flowing before the judgments and defenses kick in, or when we've let go of them for a little while. But also, by the time we start forming intimate relationships, we have experienced conditional love. And we realize we've already learned that we'll receive love and approval for certain behaviors, and we'll receive rejection or punishment for others, right? And this sort of cognitive and emotional dissonance is painful. When we start a new love relationship, we get caught up in a kind of trance of hope and expectation, don't we? Kind of excitement, newness, often hormone-fueled when we're young, particularly when we're young, but those old hormones can surprise us. Even when we think they've expired. And we think that this person is going to perfectly meet our needs and expectations. And they seem so wonderful. We share so much. They seem to love and appreciate us so well. And then as time goes on, and both are not trying quite so hard to show themselves in the best light, we start to notice things about each other that are not so lovable. Everything from mean speech and actions to leaving the toothpaste cap off or not stacking the dishwasher right. That's when all the darts and arrows start flying, right? And a common sort of refrain is, I thought you said you loved me. If you really loved me, you wouldn't fill in the blank, right? If you really loved me, you'd fill in the blank. So in this book by John Wellwood, his other book, earlier book, he talks about unconditional and conditional love and how we confuse the two. He says that unconditional love is the yes of the heart to a kind of all-embracing love. And conditional is the no of the mind to the particularity of our lives, you know, our likes and our dislikes, our personality, our temperament, how we're shaped by our family and culture. And this is what we bump up against, you know, when we start to get to know our wonderful partner a little better. And he says one way, Wellwood says, one way we confuse the two is we impose the conditional no on the unconditional yes. What he means is this happens when painful feelings arise in us, that we don't have the capacity to hold in a sense of caring presence. So we cut ourselves off from the person we perceive as having caused those painful feelings. And we constrict or we cut off the flow of love for that person. So if we think, you know, our partner has hurt our feelings, then we cut ourselves off from that flow of a kind of sincere love that we have for them, or unconditional love we have them for them. We feel like, I can't love them if they're going to hurt me in that way. Or they can't love me the way I need to be loved. This can't go on. But this kind of strategy of imposing the no on our hearts, yes, hurts our heart, right? Hurts our heart. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't remove ourselves from an abusive relationship. No, we need to have enough discernment and self-respect to know if, you know, when we're being harmed and to take care of ourselves. But so often we do give up. We give up and reject the other person as soon as the going gets rough, or we remove ourselves and move on and look for someone who will meet our hopes and expectations a little better, right? It's that shopping reflex that our culture reinforces so strongly. So then Wellwood says the other way we confuse these two kinds of love is to impose the unconditional yes on the conditional no, as though we should be completely tolerant or long-suffering in silence in the face of harmful acts or speech. Parents who think that unconditional love means letting the child do really harmful things, right? That setting the bar with a kind of artificial unconditional approval. So this is where we need the capacity to be aware of our vulnerable spots and to share them with each other. So kind of navigating between these two kinds of love is both an art and a practice, I think. And we don't have to... The Buddhist concept of the two truths, the two realities, the absolute and the relative, the absolute being unity, the ultimate, the universal, and the relative being the particular, and that these are not separate, that they are simultaneous realities. I think this can really help us in this territory of conditional, unconditional love, because these realities aren't mutually exclusive. And our practice is not to get stuck in one or the other. And this is a practice, really, of what we call the bodhisattva way. The bodhisattva being an awakened or awakening being who lives actively in the world of suffering, fluidly able to navigate in simultaneously the relative and the absolute. It's a kind of dance, really. So as to be able to help others awaken, or awaken along with, in relationship with others. So these confusions about love leave us in a kind of strange and painful dilemma. On the one hand, we yearn for love. We can't help that. And yet at the same time, we also deflect it and refuse to fully open to it because we don't want to, we don't trust it. We don't trust it. So again, we have to attend to that wound in the heart, which we feel in our whole body, our body, our heart, and mind. So I want to just take a moment to pause and just sit comfortably, but close your eyes for a minute. I want you to just close your eyes and just check in with yourself a little bit. Check in, be present with your breath. And just notice any areas of the body where you're feeling a little, any kind of holding, a little discomfort, a little contraction, or on the other hand, some warmth or softness, as I've been talking about love relationships. Just see where awareness arises in your body. And your eyes are closed so nobody can see you. And you might just want to take your hand and touch that place where you feel. You know, it might be your throat or your right over your heart. It might be your eyes. Wherever you feel a little contraction or holding, just touch that place. You can just hold your hand there or stroke or rub, pat a little. Just touch that part of yourself that feels a little constricted in a kind way. There may not be any kind of clear emotional charge along with that physical sensation, but if there is, just allow some feeling of tending or caring to arise. Just keep it simple. Just gently touch into and bring awareness to your own present experience. Okay, thank you for checking in with yourself. And now I'm going to keep talking, and I want you to keep that kind of dual awareness. You know, as you're listening to me, also just be aware of yourself as you hear my words and what might stir in you. So what I'd like to do is share two more insights that John Wellwood has that might help us in bringing awareness to that heart wound and how it impedes loving relationships. He talks about care for a growing child as a holding environment, and that means both a physical and an emotional holding in safety, right? But what that needs to be, that holding needs to be not too tight and not too loose, right? Not too tight, not too constricting, but also not lacking support. Because children and all of us need both, right? We need to be held in care, but not too tight, right? I'm going to read a little passage from him because I can't say it any better than he does. He says, there are two general types of wounding around love that lead to fear of intimacy. When parents act intrusively and do not provide enough space, then children grow up fearing that close contact with others threatens them with engulfment, control, manipulation, or violation. And when parents do not provide warm emotional contact, then children grow up fearing that relationships will lead to abandonment, loss, or deprivation. Engulfment fears generally lead to withdrawal in relationships, while abandonment fears lead to clinging. Though these two types of wounding can also show up in a variety of other ways. They can also flip, actually. You know, fear of abandonment can also create a kind of preemptive pushing away, and sometimes clinging. So what this results to in relationships is these kind of push-pull relationships. Right? I love you, get away from me. I need you, get away from me. Where one partner pursues when the other is pulling away, and then retreats when the other comes forward. Does that sound a little familiar to some of us? And sometimes it's subtle. It doesn't necessarily mean that these are extremes. But these two aspects of holding, which he calls contact and space, attunement and letting be. Correspond to the two core qualities of love, which he calls warmth and openness. So warmth, but also openness, rather than tightness. Warmth is our natural impulse to reach outside ourselves, touch and make contact, to welcome, embrace, and take delight in. Openness is our capacity to let be, to allow, to let in and receive others as they are in a gentle, spacious way, without having to dominate them or bend them to our will. So these sort of complementary ideas, I think, are really helpful. You know, the warmth and openness, contact and space. And it might help us in our relationships to bring awareness to our own patterning and our partner's patterning, so that we don't take it quite as personally. So we don't take it as personal rejection or personal insult, and we can have some insight. Often we're attracted to a person who has qualities we feel that are different from ourselves, or that we lack ourselves. But then some months or years into the relationship, we begin to be annoyed or hurt by that very quality that we thought was so great, right? So that strength and calm that we admired in our partner starts to look like rigidity and coldness. And we feel excluded by it or rejected by it. Or that liveliness and energy we admired becomes unreliability, flakiness. And we perceive these behaviors as threats to us, as darts or arrows that hurt us, and we begin to hurl these darts and arrows back and forth without insight into the source, their source, in our wounded hearts. And when we lock into those patterns, there's a word for it which is called trauma bonding. And when those habit patterns of defensiveness form around our heart wounds, they sort of congeal around what we could call the mind of grievance. We like to hang on to our grievances. And we hang on to them for dear life, because if we let them go, we might just be overwhelmed by the feeling of fear, feeling of loss, of love, or being unloved. But if we can blame others for not loving us, or for hurting us or disappointing us, then we can hold on to being right. Right? And if we can hold on to be right, then we're not as vulnerable. If you were to give the mind of grievance a voice, it sounds a lot like that inner critic voice that we talked about last week, or the outer judge. The voice of grievance often comes across as with lines like, "You always," or "You never," likes to take sort of absolute black and white stances. See if you can think of some sort of core grievance lines, like, "You don't respect me," what's a grievance that's that somebody you might, it doesn't have to be your personal one, but those kind of grievances that we really believe we're right.
And you don't appreciate me.
You don't appreciate me, right? You don't appreciate. That's a common one. You don't listen to me, right? The mind of grievance is never satisfied. That's another clue that it's the mind of grievance, and it's convinced that it's right, that it's true. Sometimes we want to hold on to our righteous certainty so much that we'd rather blow up the relationship than open up our point of view. The novelist Sue Monk Kidd, I wrote a book called The Secret Life of Bees, which I haven't read. But she said, people in general would rather die than forgive. It's that hard. If God said in plain language, I'm giving you a choice, forgive or die, a lot of people would go ahead and order their coffin. So that's her humorous take on how hard we hold to our grievances. So our practice supports us to look more deeply into the causes of our suffering and our partner's suffering. And it takes a degree of intentionality, even supported by our bodhisattva vows, our vows to practice the precepts, the vows to see into our lives, you know. We almost can't help but be influenced to some extent by the myths of romantic love that are so pervasive in our culture, that tell us that love means being swept away, overcome. And that one person, if we can just find them, will be that perfect, you know, prince or princess. Bell Hooks, the American feminist writer who died just this past year, in her book All About Love, says, time and time again, when I talk to individuals about approaching love with will and intentionality, I hear the fear expressed that this will bring an end to romance. This is simply not so. Approaching romantic love from a foundation of care, knowledge, and respect actually intensifies romance. By taking the time to communicate with a potential mate, we are no longer trapped by the fear and anxiety underlying romantic interactions that take place without discussion or the sharing of intent and desire. She also cites the therapist named Harriet Lerner, who has written a whole series of books, sort of like self-help books, and one called Life Preservers, where she says that most people, if you ask, want a partner who is mature and intelligent, loyal, trustworthy, loving and attentive, sensitive and open, kind and nurturant, competent and responsible. But she says, how many really check out their partner thoroughly before jumping into a relationship? She says, we give more care to selecting a household appliance or a car. So if we wish to have enduring, loving relationships, we need to be prepared to bring a kind of committed and generous willingness to look at our lives with compassion and wisdom, even the most painful parts of our lives and our partner's lives, and to release our grip on those grievances, those that we hold so tightly. So how do we do that? Well, there are lots of tried and true communication practices. Nonviolent communication is one that's been popular. Sometimes it's called compassionate communication. Basically, deep listening, not interrupting, taking turns, giving equal airspace, really learning how to talk to each other. Not using name-calling or blaming language, like really making that commitment, especially if your family has conditioned you to to speak in other ways than that. And particularly what's called using I statements rather than you statements. An I statement lets the other person know something about you, lets them into your experience. So they know a little window into your experience instead of you telling them what they about their behavior and what they their intention is. And so you statements often sound blaming and evoke defensiveness. And all these practices take patience and practice, and we don't always get it right. So we have to be willing to take risks and make mistakes and acknowledge them and keep going. Sometimes we need to pause and say, oh, that didn't come out the way I really intended to do. Can I just give that another try? Or sometimes we need to give each other a timeout and go get some fresh air and breathe and move our bodies and come back to the conversation with fresh energy. But besides communication techniques, and they are worthwhile, we need to keep coming back to these practices of the heart, to kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity for ourselves and our partners. Just stopping and sitting quietly, breathing, and feeling into a softening of the heart. For those of you who haven't done these practices, unlike regular, just our zazen practice, we close our eyes and we use just simple phrases that we repeat silently to ourselves that express our wish or intention for extending kindness or compassion, joy or equanimity to ourselves and others. And we can't go do it really into detail with these practices. But we've done a little bit each time. So what I'm going to ask you to do, and I actually have a sheet with a lot of possible suggested phrases that you can use. And this sheet is out on the kitchen table if you'd like to have one. And I will post a PDF of it on the event page for this series on the website for folks who can't come here. But I'd like to just give you a little taste of how this practice works. So if you sit comfortably again and close your eyes, and I'm going to ask you first, I'm going to just read some phrases. And these are adapted from the ones from Thich Nhat Hanh's book on love. So I'm going to read the phrases and just allow them to resonate for you as I read them. And I'll start reading the phrases for you to apply to yourself, and then I'll read them one more time, and I'd like you to choose a person that, if you are in a relationship now, a love relationship, to choose that person. And if you're not, that's okay. See, if choose someone you're very close to, like a very close friend. Friendship is a kind of undervalued and underconsidered kind of relationship in our hyper-busy Facebook culture. But friends, like lovers, can be both a delight and they can also hurt us deeply. So please choose someone who you're very close to for the second part of this. So first, sit and feel your breath and your body. And I'm going to repeat some phrases. May I see myself deeply with the eyes of love and understanding. May I see the sources of greed, hate, and delusion in myself. May I nourish the seeds of joy and happiness in myself. Okay, now let someone you're very close to come to mind, and you can picture them in your mind's eye if you like. It could be your intimate partner or a very close friend. And I'm going to say, may they, but you can say may he or she or they in your mind. May they see themselves deeply with the eyes of love and understanding. May they see the sources of greed, hate, and delusion in themselves. May they nourish the seeds of joy and happiness in themselves. Okay, thank you for doing that very short little heart practice. But please help yourself to one of these papers, and it'll give you some possibilities. Even to do, you know, in your home practice, even if you do maybe 5 minutes or so of your meditation using these heart practices, and they can be really opening and softening to do. And next week, we are going to look even further into this mind of grievance as we consider how to love those who are really hard to love, those who do harm, those who hurt us, or those who do harm in the world. So it's traditional when you do these heart practices to start with yourself, and then start with somebody who's really easy, and then go out until it gets harder to do the difficult people. And then on the final week, we'll look at extending love on to all beings on the large scale and receiving large scale love. So that's where we're headed. And I have taken quite a long time. So rather than do small groups tonight, as we have, I'm going to stop the recording.